651-989-5855 is the phone number, or use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter. You want to comment on anything that we've been covering this morning, including the chaotic end to the legislative session. Obviously, we will follow the fate of these bills here over the next few days and be joined, hopefully, by Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka for a debriefing tomorrow.
Yeah, there was a couple more items of note, and then we'll move on to a few dozen a few other issues, including we're going to get our counterterrorism expert David Gartenstein Ross on the show later this week. But we'll give you some points out of the Star Tribune article about these Somali child care providers, and we'll consult with David later this week on the Somalia angle, Al Shabaab money going there. If there's a larger issue at play, one other legislative session item out of Channel 5, and we talked about this quite a bit last week. State lawmakers gut the tougher distracted driving bills, while increasing fines for texting and driving. One bill would have made it a felony for using a cell phone while driving and causing a crash, which resulted in serious injury or death. Representative Keith Franke, authored the felony distracted driving bill, said he was disappointed the tougher sentencing provisions were dropped from the bill, but he's happy to get something done. Under the compromise, the hand-free bill and the representative's bill would have new language that carries a second offense penalty for distracted driving while using a cell phone from $150 to $300. If a driver gets a third distracted driving offense while using a cell phone within 5 years of the first two offenses, the penalty increases to $500, a mandatory court appearance and a misdemeanor criminal conviction.
Yeah. Again, this is something that's inevitable. Maybe the next session, maybe the session after that, but it's not going anywhere. This effort to completely ban all cell phone use while driving and only allow hands-free devices will become law in Minnesota eventually.
My curiosity rests on the social dynamic angle of using our phones and our iPads and how that's going to end up playing into this, because there does appear to be, and this is all just anecdotal, but there does appear to be a growing sense of sort of detaching yourself from your screens, from your phone and your iPad. And I imagine that as we continue to have these discussions for places that haven't adopted these distracted driving bills, or that those that have, and we see some of the data that comes out, that there's going to be an inevitable reduction that may not be directly tied to further laws and may be more tied to sort of social standards changing and also emerging sort of car technology as well. I'm hesitant to say we've reached peak stupid when it comes to distracted driving.
We've been wrong on that every single time.
Yeah, we've been wrong on peak stupid so often. Yeah. But I do think that if we have the potential to make it be peak stupid right now, that we're getting closer. But again, I have absolutely no evidence to back that up whatsoever. That's just based off of my own.
It just feels like
it. It does feel that, because I know I feel much, much better leaving my phone away from me. I have this growing sense of joy of putting my phone and my iPad in another room and being able to walk away for a certain amount of time, and I feel like I've accomplished something.
Right. You haven't. But it feels like
that. But I have. But I kind of have, because I've been able to go and put that away for a little while and not messed with it. So 651-989-5855. Real quick, and again, we'll talk with David Gartenstein Ross about this later in the week, but Somali child care providers are pushing back against the fraud and terrorist allegations. They contend misdeeds by daycare providers that fed scrutiny are in the past. So there was one individual, co-founder of Minnesota's largest association of minority-owned daycare centers, who was upset and basically said, why are we not allowed to testify? Talking about that Senate committee hearing that took place last week. Well, it wasn't a trial yet. I mean, this was sort of the opening of a potential and expanding look into investigations that were already taking place of daycare centers. I mean, to say that this scrutiny is in the past is just not true. You have 10 daycare centers that are currently being investigated.
Right.
The numbers have been increasing.
Right.
Even if you don't even look at the whistleblowers' comments that we discussed last week. So to say that this is of the past is, I can understand their frustration if you're a legitimate Somali-owned daycare center that's not involved in corruption.
I would be very frustrated as well, because it is being, you know, people are sort of casting a very wide net in their commentary around this issue. So if you are a Somali-owned, if you run a Somali-owned child care center and you've been doing everything by the book, I would be very angry too.
Yeah.
Because it don't look good, and there's going to be a lot of suspicion. But the fact of the matter is that this has been going on. There is an investigation. There are plenty of facilities that are under suspicion, that are under investigation, and the investigation is going to play out. She's right in the sense that, you know, if you're going to have a Senate hearing, people that are running the legitimate businesses should have had an opportunity to testify, but you know, let the investigation play.
Right.
James Noble's legislative auditor is looking into this as well. He is probably the fairest man in Minnesota. So, you know, what we need to know will come to light.
Well, and if there is, and I do agree, if there is further investigation into this, or further committee hearings, then the individuals within the community who run reputable daycare centers, they should be allowed to come in and give their side of the story. I imagine, though, within the Somali community, and again, this is me, this is just opinion, right, based off of no evidence. I imagine within the Somali community, though, that the daycare centers that are on the up and up are probably very well known. Right. I mean, like any business, like any community that has a majority living in it, I imagine that if you have businesses that are conducting the same type of business, that it's probably pretty well known which ones are on the up and up and which ones are not.
And we said this when we were covering it last week, and we will focus on this angle of it when we talk to David Gartenstein Ross. But, you know, make sure that, you know, this becomes less about it being Somali run daycares and more about how easy it is to defraud the state.
Right, right.
Because I guarantee you there are non-Somali-run daycare, childcare centers that are also defrauding the state. They're just not necessarily putting the money in briefcases and sending it to Somalia,
right,
where it's likely ending up in the hands of Al-Shabaab.
Well, and that's where the focus of that investigation and the whistleblower commentary from last week, and you know, just to kind of repeat what we said last week. Look, the funding terrorism angle of it is headline grabbing. That was not the core of what the whistleblower was saying. The whistleblower was simply saying, money is flying out of MSP. This is what I want you guys to know. These are the places that it's headed. One of those places is also Somalia, that's ran by a terrorist organization that's really, really good at, you know, murder and terrorism.
Yeah, a lot of murder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so if money goes there where they don't have legitimate banks and they have to use these mawalas, then yeah, the terror guys are getting a slice of that dough. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go here. You talk a little light rail? 200 homeless people use light rail. They use it to sleep. Minnesota homeless are seeking shelter on the light rail system. Well, you know, good news is somebody's using it. 85% of homeless people on the system have paid fares, aren't doing anything illegal, according to those that work within light rail. The social service agencies may buy homeless people bus or train tokens when they run out of room.
Metro. This is the most expensive affordable housing initiative that anybody could have thought of.
Right, and not very convenient. I mean, how hard? It's got to be hard to get a good night's sleep on light rail, right?
It's like the tone of this article is almost like, oh, look, we found a solution.
Right.
So, okay, they can just sleep on the light rail.
By the way, I like how they throw out the 85% of homeless people on the system are paying for fares.
And you know, 15% aren't.
Right. That's kind of the bigger percentage of the two.
They let us know long ago that they don't really care if you pay your fares or not.
Metro Transit has received complaints from riders about night train conditions. Homeless people often don't have anywhere else to go, they say. There's a continuous lack of available shelter and not enough funding for additional shelter beds. We recognize that we're not in the best place, but we also recognize that for a mom and her kid, it's safe, it's dry. If somebody's bothering them, the police come right away. Now, to what you were saying a moment ago. Then we're going to spin this over into the first State of the City address from the St. Paul Mayor, Melvin Carter. An affordable housing shortage is contributing to the homeless problem. This was according to the St. Paul Mayor, Melvin Carter. The city has opened a temporary shelter in the winter, but the $400,000 cost was only funded through March. Catholic Charities plans to open an opportunity center next year. The downtown housing complex will replace an older shelter and provide an additional 200 housing units. The complex will give preference to veterans, young people leaving foster care. One point to make on this, by the way, the Catholic Charities, you have the city opened temporary shelter, $400,000 costs, only funded through March. Look, said it before, say it again, get the government out of this and you'll see the public step up to help with the problem. Because right now there's a big portion of the population that doesn't bother to help in homeless outreach because they defaulted to the, well, the government's taking care of it. Yeah. We saw this with global warming. We had the story about global warming and the amount of individuals who believe in global warming. They're not contributing because they think the federal government is dealing with the problem.
Yeah, it's one of the more sort of insidious side effects of deferring to the government to solve all the problems is you're abdicating yourself of having to make to take any responsibility and take any action. And so many people that just raise taxes and have taxes pay for it. What you're basically saying is I don't feel like contributing or making any sort of sacrifice or any sort of contribution to help with this problem. Just take a few more bucks out of my paycheck and I'm just going to assume it's taken care of.
It was probably early on in Obama's presidency and then later on in the presidency of the 8 years he was in office. We can't win. And what I mean by that is this. You had the opportunity with a president in President Barack Obama, and I know what I'm about to say flies completely in the face of what that particular president represented about what he believes the role of government is.
Yeah.
To just follow me down this road. The thing that I always found so frustrating was here you had a guy who, in my opinion, you cannot argue against how great a speaker he was. He was, right? He was compelling. He was compelling to listen to.
He oozed charisma.
He oozed charisma. You know, he was the Oscar Isaac of presidents. Right? Just had a connection with everybody. And here you had an individual who, if they were a conservative, fiscally responsible, who better to go and strip away the government's role in assisting people's lives and encourage the public at large to step up, to donate, to help. And yet it was the complete opposite of that. He wanted to grow the government. The government's here to support your mediocre lifestyle. But we can't win because now we got the guy in office who is doing great things for the economy, but the last thing he is inspiring to anybody.
Right.
You know, who you end up not being able to win. And when it comes to charity outreach, that's probably the thing that frustrates me the most is, man, if you got the government to step aside and then you unleash the potential of the public,
right,
of private dollars.
What I would like to see is a leader step up and actually have a very stern talk with America. And say, look, these problems that you're experiencing in your communities and your cities and in your areas, they're your problems. You're going to have to figure out a way to fix them. You're going to have to work together, band together. Everybody's going to have to chip in and contribute a little bit. Not by mandate from the government,
right,
but by their own accord, their voluntary accord, and deciding that they're going to try to help alleviate this problem using whatever skills, talents, or resources they personally have, whether it be money or whether it be volunteering or whether it be time or expertise or whatever it may be. But somebody needs to tell the entire country that the federal government can't fix your problems in your community. Your state government probably can't fix your problems in your communities. You can, though. get out there, make some sacrifices, get involved, you know, find charities that you like to work with, find charities that you can donate to if you have the means and resources, get involved and actually do something. And if everybody did that, if every community really did that, you would see so many of these problems just wither away.
Yeah. Maybe not vanish overnight, but certainly be taken care of in a way the government never could. And you see it in examples, all the time of when you have these, especially in the wake of tragic events, right? This is probably one of the ones, having been involved in these before, but a police officer loses their life in the line of duty under the worst circumstances, and you see the community outreach come, pouring in, individuals donating their dollars.
Yeah, you see it all the time.
You look at the ALS and the ice bucket challenge and the amount of money they were able to raise over a particular cause because it was able to get attention.
Yeah.
And then again, we'll get into this to the same part because it dovetails into this Melvin Carter State of the City address and the $15 minimum wage fight. It's just it's lost opportunity after lost opportunity when you have this mindset that the government is going to go and solve all of your societal problems.
651-989-5855. More on that, more on St. Paul. Plus, Representative Jason Lewis joins us in about 20 minutes. We will be speaking with Representative Jason Lewis in it's about 15 minutes or so, coming up at the beginning of the next segment. He had some town halls over the weekend, and we all know, we've discussed it a number of times, this sort of fake push for town halls by groups like Indivisible and other political community organizing groups, and all just an attempt to get, a Republican representative up there so they can yell at him. And then when they don't hold the town halls because they don't want to be yelled at by a bunch of activists, then they accuse them of not meeting with their constituents. It's this fake ploy. So Jason Lewis held some town halls, and they were ticketed only events. It was free, but you had to have a ticket. And then that wasn't good enough because not the right people didn't get tickets.
Yeah, I don't think we should waste Jason Lewis's time with this portion of what took place on Saturday afternoon, so we can get it out of the way now real quick. But outside the Rose Henge Hall in Lakeville, an impromptu choir launched into a full-throttled protest. Oh, I wish we had given this to you. You could sing along with us. But to the tune of the Wheels on the Bus, one group sang, new laws in the house are cruel and dumb, cruel and dumb, cruel and dumb. The new laws in the house are cruel and dumb all year round.
You know, at least they're getting a little bit more, creative. I give them that. On the bright side.
Children.
They're a bunch of idiots.
Just children.
Hey, Governor Mark Dayton wrote those lyrics. Oh, that's awesome. And I'm going to go and veto them, veto them, veto them.
Oh, my goodness. So we will we'll catch up with Jason as well. We'll get his thoughts on the town halls and other issues as well coming up in the next segment.
In his first State of the City address, Melvin Carter, St. Paul mayor, talks wages, police, gun violence, story out of the Pioneer Press. He praised St. Paul's Police Department's recent public outreach and called for everyday residents to step up and serve St. Paul. Everyday residents to step up and serve St. Paul. Also praised efforts for students who have called for state and federal lawmakers to take a tougher stand on gun violence, an issue that once again was in the news after 10 were killed Friday in the school shooting in Santa Fe, Texas. Quick point on that. If we have time, we can get into it more later on after we talk with Jason Lewis. But I do find it interesting, to say the least, that was a horrible shooting that took place in Texas. The coverage over the weekend and even today has been not nearly as covered as what took place in Parkland, Florida. And my cynical line of thinking goes to the fact that the difference is you have in Parkland students that were very quick to go and politicize what took place in a more liberal area of the country, whereas in Texas you don't have students who stepped up to politicize it in a place where they respect your right to keep and bear arms more. I can't help but think that, among other factors, a lot of news over the weekend when it took place, that's part of the reason why that story Because it's just, look, it's just as horrible. It's just, there's as much to talk about and unpack in what took place in Texas on Friday as there was in Parkland, Florida. The background on this guy, the pressure bombs that apparently, the pressure cooker bombs and other explosives that he put around the campus that didn't go off, thank God, right? There's just as much there, but not nearly the coverage that we got before.
Yeah.
Just wasn't making the headlines like it did. You know, and again, that's not me complaining about that. There's just it's just an observation.
It's interesting to note the dynamics in play that sort of determine how big a story turns out to be.
Yep. All right, back to Melvin Carter. State of the City address delivered before a crowded auditorium at Johnson High School in St. Paul's East Side highlighted a series of initiatives already in the work. Among them, the mayor recently launched a task force, we talked about that, to study how to best roll out the $50 college savings accounts for every child in the city.
Cool.
Yay.
Here's 50 bucks.
Carter said, on occasion,
good luck with that $40,000 a year tuition. Who knows what it's going to cost by the time you're 18, but here's 50 bucks.
On occasion,
don't spend it all in one place, kid.
People look at me and say, $50 isn't enough to pay for college.
What?
To which Carter, to widespread laughter, says, I say, really? Research shows us that children from low-income families who have even a small amount of money saved up are 3 times more likely to go.
So we're just going to give them...
We're going to give them the hope.
Look,
Drew?
The reason why that statistic exists is because the effort and sacrifice that it takes to save money is a lesson that people learn, and when you just give it to them, they're not saving it. It's not like it's just magically, I have a savings account, now suddenly college is a priority. Now suddenly I'm going to start working hard. No. It's the effort that it takes and the lessons you learn in the sacrifices that you make that make you value savings, that make you value this path more.
You don't say.
Here's a savings account. Now, magically, suddenly, you care.
I know for you listening, this particular story is unnecessary. But for you, in case you don't realize this, if you'd like a real world example of this, I have a real world example. My two wonderful boys, my wonderful soon to be 16-year-old son Logan, right, received for Christmas he has to build it from scratch, right? He gets all the components, but it's a remote control plane. He's a great RC plane flyer, so he received this as a gift for Christmas. This remote control plane, okay, gift. Put it together, it flies just great. To be honest, he threw it together kind of quickly, right? Wanted to get it built as quickly as possible so he can get it up in the air. And he himself was a little bit unsatisfied with the work that he did.
Right.
So he wanted to purchase another one. I said, well, if you want to purchase another one, you got to pay for every single bit of it on your own. You're going to have to earn that money. You're going to have to save your allowance. You're going to have to do extra things around the house. And that's just what he did. So for several months, he earned the money, would go and order the parts that he wanted, and slowly the parts would come home. And he has been meticulous in putting this thing together. He's taken his time, made sure that everything fits the right way. It's functioning the right way. The amount of effort and how closely he is paying attention to every small detail, right, of this, the difference night and day between earning the money on his own, the pride that he's taking in it, and getting the other one for a gift.
Yeah. It's the ownership.
Yeah.
It's the ownership element. This is his. He owns it. He's earned it. He's working for it. Therefore, he values it more.
Right. And look, it was...
He's going to take better care of it.
It was a lesson for me as a dad because, to be honest, I was annoyed. It's exactly the same plane. And I was annoyed because I'm like, we got that one as a gift. And why does he, and it took me a while before I stopped and I had to just like smack myself upside the head and go, dude, it's as obvious why he likes the one that he got, but this means so much more to him. Carter acknowledged that nuanced discussions lie ahead between his administration and the city council. Together, the mayor and council will determine how to best increase the citywide minimum wage based in part on recommendations from the Citizens League, which will be compiled this summer to help a committee of workers, businesses, business owners, and civic leaders.
They're not going to determine whether to increase the citywide minimum wage. They're just going to meet to determine how best to increase it. It's going to happen. They've made up their mind. There is no further discussion on whether or not the city of St. Paul is going to be increasing the minimum wage.
Well, and you had a subsequent story talking about one council member representing the most small businesses is torn over the $15 an hour minimum wage. But the reality is when you get into this Q&A with the council member, R word, by the way, council member Rebecca Knocker, it's not about not having the minimum wage. It's about how quickly do you go and get to that $15? And this is what we've been finding out. We had that that comprehensive study that was done out of Seattle where they have the incremental increases in the minimum wage, and what they've discovered is on the smaller amounts, the impact was somewhat positive. It actually had a net positive for individuals. But as you crept closer and closer to the $15 minimum wage, and when you got to the $15 minimum wage, it ended up having a negative impact on the individuals that it was supposed to go and benefit. So what you see now is sort of this, you know, we're talking about nuance, but this, well, you know, it really is about how long it takes to get there. Everyone is 100% agreed the wage needs to be increased. But $15 isn't pegged to any particular income. I think if you work full-time, this is what drives me nuts. I think if you work full-time, said the city council member, at the minimum wage, you should be able to keep your family out of poverty. Okay. So you've decided that.
That's all right.
You know everybody's spending habits, size of their family, you know, things they buy, you're paying attention. You should be able to keep your family out of poverty at $15. And $15 doesn't necessarily correspond to that. Now, the 15 now effort makes people think it's going to be 15 tomorrow instead of a gradual rollout. Do you peg it to inflation? If we did 13 next year, would that be better than 15 in 5 years, for instance? At the end of the day, if you raise the wage and jobs are lost, that doesn't help people either. We know this already.
Yeah, we've seen this happen. We've seen it happen in Seattle. We've seen it happen in San Francisco. We've seen it happen in plenty of municipalities that, in areas that have increased the minimum wage. We have the data. It's all there for you to peruse.
So they asked her.
We know how this script plays out.
Yeah, we know the end of the story. Yeah,
we've seen it before.
It's bad.
Yeah.
It does not work out well. Oh, I was going to do. I was stop because I was going to do a recent reference, and for that would have been
you'd gone down a pop culture rabbit.
I just didn't want to go and spoil it for people that perhaps even who are involved in the show that still may not have seen certain films. They've been out recently, or may have been out in the recent past. I'm not being specific on that. One more quick point on this article with Rebecca Knocker. They ask her, so it's not about the number 15. It's about how quickly we get there. Minneapolis chose to implement the $15 an hour by 2022 for large businesses and 2024 for small ones. People are talking as if Seattle has already reached $15 an hour, but in reality, employers that pay their employees medical benefits have been given a couple extra years to reach 15. New York is also more than a year away from the rollout of 15, to which she responded, it's the number when. It's the number when.
That's not a number.
That is definitely not a number.
When a number?
I'm not, you know, if, I was homeschooled, but I'm pretty sure that's not a number.
How about we just make the minimum wage at when per hour?
Yeah, let's do that. What about when you go to a restaurant and they say when? Am I saying is?
Was that a time?
Is that a time frame that I'm not aware of?
Mind blown.
It's the number when. That's a good like movie name. It's a good like art house film name. The number when. We keep hearing, and it's true, that small businesses are getting overregulated. Huh. Our small business owners are also people who work and live in St. Paul. Huh. And first generation immigrants. I want to be thoughtful about the impact on them. If that means a longer phase-in time, I think the questions of youth wage and training are important. If anybody, if a minimum wage causes anybody to lose hours, that's not what anybody wants. Then you need to stop now. Get off of this number when, because it's not a number.
Yeah.
And get off this minimum wage road that you're on and make that 100% agreed a 99% agree with you being the 1% that disagrees, because that's exactly what's going to happen if you land and when you land on that $15 an hour wage.
Yeah. Well, I share your sentiment. I wish I had any optimism.
Oh, I have no optimism. No. Yeah. I believe it'll happen number when.
Yeah. this train of stupid is barreling down the tracks. There ain't gonna be no stopping it. Joining us next, Representative Jason Lewis.
Final segment of Monday's show. Justice and Drew, along with Sam, 651-989-5855, and you can always use that hashtag TCNT on Twitter.
Joining us now, Representative Jason Lewis. Good morning, sir. Doing fantastic. So you had some town halls over the weekend. We got a story here from NPR News, which I thought was kind of funny because, you know, you hold these town halls and you meet with constituents, and there's really not much in the coverage of this that talks about what actually happened at the town halls. Apparently the bigger story are just the handful of people that were upset that they didn't get a ticket.
Yeah, you know what's odd about that is we issued a number of tickets, and we did try to do it by zip code. We had to go through a protocol because we had some security problems. So we issued a number of tickets, and clearly a few people who got tickets didn't show. And I don't know, you know, there's nothing I can do about that. It wasn't that many of them, though. We had a great crowd everywhere we went. And in fact, what was sort of amazing about it was the substance of issues we got into. There weren't as many protests as a lot of people thought there might be as well. So I was very pleased with the town halls and of course, Waubusha and then Lakeville and over in Jordan. We had great crowds. We had great conversations. Talked a lot about health care and how Minnesota is at an inflection point in health care still, because contrary to the reforms we tried, we still have the Affordable Care Act here. Minnesota Department of Health, you know, issued this report here a month or so ago. 116,000 more people have lost their coverage, 350,000 total. We are now have the highest uninsured rate since 2001 at 6.3%. And get ready for a premium hike in October. The folks who fought so hard to preserve Obamacare need to answer to all of this. This is totally dysfunctional, and we need reform. So that came up. Obviously, the tragedy in Parkland as well as Santa Fe came up. Good conversations there. It was great. But look, this is not anything we haven't been doing.
Right.
When they say, well, you're not meeting with constituents, we've had over 271 meetings with groups. In fact, what was humorous, a couple of people came up and said, well, I met with you in your office, and then they started to complain that they weren't having access. Well, you met with me in the office. You're here at the town hall asking questions. There's 700,000 people in the district. I'd say you're getting your fair share.
When you talk about, some of the topics that were discussed at the event, spin back for just a moment. I'm curious what you were hearing from those that attended when it comes to in the wake of that tragic Texas shooting on Friday. Of course, you know, Parkland, Florida, that got to so much attention. What were you hearing from the individuals that attended?
Yeah, I think people want something done, but there's a real divide as to what to do. I mean, Santa Fe was another example. If you're just going to pass a law as window dressing and nothing's going to get done, you know, my litmus test has always been do what works. And so you had a disturbed young man again who got a .38 caliber revolver, got a shotgun, and had some crazy idea to go into the school and shoot up his classmates, which is really the root cause. What is driving our young people to want to do this? That's what we ought to be addressing. But all of the proposed laws, whether it's bump stocks, high-capacity magazines, gun show loophole closing, wouldn't have stopped this young man, wouldn't have stopped the man in Parkland. And so the question becomes, do you want more laws or do you want more school resource officers? Do you want a slogan or do you want to actually harden schools to get the vestibules secure so you have to check into school? Do you have to go through a metal detector if it need be? I think that's what people want. They want to stop this any way they can, as do I. And what's the best way to do it? And folks aren't certain that passing new laws is just the best way to do it.
Yeah, they want to stop it. But when you actually talk about tangible measures you can take to make schools less of a soft target, it's like the conversation just hits a wall. You know, they don't want to have that conversation. They don't want to go down that road. This is less about making schools more safe and more about the, you know, just continuing to push that gun control agenda that certain groups. It frustrates me to see genuine, real problems and issues get co-opted by ulterior agendas. And that's what's happening here when you talk about school safety and school shootings.
Yeah, we shouldn't be going down the road of politicizing any tragedy. And again, all I would say is the law, closing the gun show loophole, for instance, a private, if your uncle gives you a family heirloom, now that's got to be registered with the background check. That wouldn't have stopped Parkland. That wouldn't have stopped Santa Fe. The banning bump stocks or high capacity magazines wouldn't have stopped Parkland, wouldn't have stopped Santa Fe. So what can we do that might have saved more lives? Well, we know these things happen early in the morning. Almost all these shootings happen early in the morning. We ought to be beefing up security then. The Stop School Violence Act, which I supported, does allocate more money for smart technology for schools. Use it. Those are the things we can do right now. Even if you pass another law, it's got to go through committee. It's got to be marked up. If somebody's planning an attack next week, it's not going to do much. So I just think that's been my litmus test from the get-go. How can we do something that actually will have a difference? And we had a great discussion on that, pros and cons from both sides.
Well, and when it comes to, you know, what can you sort of immediately do, that's, in my opinion, that's about it. Because the other things that you can do aren't items that are going to be able to be worked through in a town hall, because we really do need to be having the conversation of what's going on in the minds of these young men that's bringing them to the point where they now have no regard or for life, and they're willing to go and lose their own and take as many with them as possible in doing so. And those are tough discussions that need to be have, and they're not ones that are going to immediately fix anything overnight. Those are going to be ongoing discussions that need to take place.
Yeah, they're not easy answers. Our gun ownership levels are actually lower than they were three decades ago per home, and yet we have more of these, or what seems to be more of these mass shootings. So there's a root cause here of young people. Is it fatherless boys being raised? Is it too many psychotropic drugs? Is it narcissism? Is it violent videos? None of us have those good, hard answers, but that's the problem. If you're just looking for a political gotcha moment, you don't want to drill down there because you're not going to get what you want. And that is a problem when you've got, you know, when you have political campaigns trying to politicize town halls, you're not going to get those sorts of honest conversations. But I have to say, I was very pleased with all three of them, and I think we did have some good conversations in some cases.
I want to shift gears a little bit while I got you on the phone, because I know this issue falls into one of your wheelhouses. When you talk about trade, the president's been tweeting this morning about China. China has agreed to buy massive amounts of additional farm and agricultural products. Would be one of the best things to happen to our farmers in many years. He tweeted a little bit later, under our potential deal with China, they will purchase from our great American farmers practically as much as our farmers can produce. Have you been following these negotiations with China? And what are your thoughts on where things stand? The talk of a trade war has certainly been tamped down over the weekend, and the talk of tariffs has been tamped down a bit.
Well, the ZTE issue is problematic just because of national security concerns and where you want high tech equipment being built that can be used for some nefarious purpose. But look, half our soybean market goes to China. So if you take a look at where we're selling abroad, China is a big market. So it's good news that the president can cut a deal that would preserve the status quo and maybe up it a bit when it comes to our ag exports abroad. I think the president's modus operandi, whether it's DACA, whether it's trade, is to start over here to finally get here, to finally get to a deal. What I've been telling folks is, look, just be patient and let's see what the final deal looks like before anybody starts to panic too much. And I'm cautiously optimistic we're going to get to something that's going to be good for Minnesota.
Jason, we have a listener who wants to ask you a question. You mind taking a call with us?
Not at all.
Okay, this is just to give you a set the table a little bit. This is one of our favorite listeners, giant fan of the show. Always always has something very positive to contribute. Don in Burnsville. Good morning.
Sure. Good morning. If you watch TV this weekend, you probably saw the governor of Connecticut tell how they have passed a number of common sense gun control laws, and as a result, they have a per capita rate of violent crimes of half that of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a question?
Yeah, there's a question. Why the hell don't the rest of the country pass similar laws?
Well, we do have a number of gun laws. In Minnesota, the age requirement, because of our hunting culture, is lower than a lot of other states. So young people want to be able to have their rifles to hunt as long as they have an adult with them at age 16. And that's a long tradition in Minnesota, and I'm not certain that's the root cause of the problem. You know, Bernie Sanders, speaking of the Northeast, Bernie Sanders voted against the Brady Bill 5 times. Yeah, that Bernie Sanders. Because Vermont has the same sort of hunting culture, and they didn't think it would be effective, and as it turns out, it wasn't that effective. But I will tell you, I voted for Fix Nick so that the Attorney General has to make certain federal departments are reporting abusive husbands to, let's say, from the Air Force to Texas authorities or to the FBI, as we saw in that Texas case. That didn't happen. I voted for the Stop School Violence Act so we can get some of these funds to harden the targets.
Yeah.
No one supports automatic weapons from 1934, the 1968 law, being in the hands of the general public. So there are laws on the books. The question is, if you go any further, would it do any good? And do you agree with Justice John Paul Stevens that we just ought to flat out repeal the Second Amendment? I don't.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, I mean, honestly, if you really want the stricter gun control that a lot of these people are advocating for, that's the conversation that they're going to have to engage in with the nation. You know, until they repeal the Second Amendment, it's going to be very difficult to pass the type of regulations and restrictions that they really are, no pun intended, gunning for. Representative Jason.
Then you don't have assurance that something's going to get done. 97% of the gun crimes in Chicago are done with illegally obtained guns,
of course,
on the black market. You know, that's going to be very difficult to remove that.
Representative Lewis, thank you so much for your time this morning. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, gang. Good to talk with you.
Look forward to catching up with you real soon.
Let's go and talk with Joe in Minneapolis. Wants to respond to a fan of the show, Don in Burnsville. Good morning, Joe. Welcome to Twin Cities News Talk.
Good morning. I just wanted to tell Don, move to Connecticut, please.
No, because then, well, I guess he could listen from there.
He
could,
yeah, yeah, the iHeart app.
Yeah, he could do that on the iHeart app.
Thanks, Joe.
Why don't we do it over? What do you do over there? All right, let's go here. We got enough time. Star Tribune. Okay, what began, Drew, Sam, with complaints of from a handful of Twin City conservationists about the glass walls at U.S. Bank Stadium is now a scientific study that could have a far-ranging effect on birds and buildings.
Oh, boy.
Birds again?
That's right.
Everybody cares so much about birds.
The state and the Vikings are paying $300,000 to study the dangers to birds built into the 2-year-old stadium with this massive glass facades and doors.
Why? They're not going to... It's not like they're going to, like, tear it down. You're going to spend $300,000 to study it. What if the study comes back that this thing is just a bird-killing machine and there's absolutely nothing that can be done about it? Okay, then what?
Okay, back up. How much money?
It's $300,000.
Can they give me $300,000 and I'll sit out on a lawn chair for a month?
You'll be the countermeasure? Yes. You'll be the scarecrow?
I will count these birds for $300,000 day in and day out.
The MSFA still hasn't addressed the expense of the darkening solution to block the excessive light during the NCAA men's basketball Final Four next April. They still haven't figured out how to pay for that, but we are dropping $300,000 to study why the birds are clunk smashing into the glass at U.S. Bank Stadium.
Is that the sound they make?
It is the sound they make. Yeah. Clunk.
Yeah, it's because birds are dumb.
Leading the effort is Scott Loss, an assistant professor at Oklahoma State University with strong academic bona fides. Ooh. The study is not just looking at U.S. Bank Stadium, but also other parts of the region and weather patterns. So are we going to move? We're going to move it? We're going to turn it?
Can we just rotate it?
Lift it up. All right, everybody lift.
Well,
turn.
I think it's clear what has to happen. We need to figure out how much it's going to cost to put U.S. Bank Stadium on a giant Lazy Susan so that as the weather patterns change, you can simply just shift the stadium around so that it doesn't align with the migration patterns. The focus on two fall and spring migration seasons, with the last coming this fall. The results won't be public until next year after the results undergo rigorous scientific peer review. So how much of that $300,000, how much of that $300,000 is going to individuals or is going to stand down at U.S. Bank Stadium to watch the birds fly into it? Oh, there's another one. There's another one. Loss said it's well established that birds crash into buildings, and the study will quantify the problem at U.S. Bank Stadium while also looking at the broader suite of buildings. Throughout the construction of the stadium, funded with money from the state and the Vikings, the MSFA rejected pleas to make the building bird-friendly, arguing the bird deterrents, such as etched glass, would interfere with the airy aesthetic of the building.
Right, right. They've clearly made the determination that they value aesthetics more than the lives of birds.
Yeah. The MSFA chairman, Mike Vekic, didn't come on board until last year, so he wasn't involved in the earlier discussions. His position is, we're open to looking at mitigation, yes. They need, like, countermeasures. You know, it just maybe fans to blow the birds in a different direction.
Yeah, that's ultimately what they're looking at is the migratory pattern. You know, being along the Mississippi, that's where birds like to fly. With a quote in here from Peters, I don't see her first name. Says we are hoping to get them through these downtown areas so that they can get to the parks and the breeding grounds. Trying to get the birds to the parks.
Build a giant habitat, but basically like a big flight habitat trail for the birds.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to rebrand the Vikings to like some big cat logo.
Just like make it a part of the theme. Yeah,
Minnesota feral cats.
There you go. Maybe just put a bunch of cats around just to scare them away.
I mean, you want to talk about something that kills a lot of birds.
Yeah, right. Sure, yeah,
cats
right.
kill millions of birds.
Yeah, way more than U.S. Bank Stadium can do.
And they do it for fun. They don't just do it because they're in the way. They do it because it's fun.
They don't even do it because they're hungry.
Yeah.
It's just a hobby to them.
Right.
Daniel Clem says, whenever you have birds and glass together, you're going to have kills. And you got a lot of glass. You're going to have a lot of kills.
A lot of kills.
The killing glass.
That's right. Big killing machine.
Just somebody should write a novel about U.S. Bank Stadium just being on like a bird hunting.
100,000. You know who's happy if the birds are dying? The people that got the $300,000 to study this.
You know, these studies seem so made up. Like, where's this money actually go?
Yeah, seriously.
Have a wonderful day, everybody. Tomorrow on the show, Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka, Pete Hegseth, Fox News, and more. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day. I don't give me generation. Give me true communication. I don't give me sorrow. I want equal opportunity to live tomorrow. I hear Coach Pepper. I'm Chris Addison.